Welcome to Failing Up, a podcast where we explore failure.
Why we're afraid of it, why we try to avoid it, and the success that can arise directly from it.
Failure comes in many shapes and forms. It can even mean different things to different people.
This show, Failing Up, intends to explore all aspects. These are the stories of people who have experienced profound failures that ultimately led them to something positive.
We hope this helps us all learn and grow. Thanks for listening.
My name is Eden.
And I'm Guy.
Very worthy of a listen.
And just so I'm making sure I'm correct, is it Matarazzo?
Matarazzo.
Okay, I did all right.
You did all right.
Yeah, well, I mean, I grew up in Jersey, so...
There you go.
I'm used to these kind of Italian-sounding last names. Anyway, you want to just get started?
Sure.
Okay. Heather Matt... Oh, Jesus Christ, of course.
We can edit that out.
Heather Matarazzo, thank you for being here.
Thank you for being here.
On Failing Up, we really appreciate you coming here. I don't know if you've listened to the show before, but what we like to do is start from the beginning. So I know you are an East Coaster.
Yes.
You were born in New York.
Yes.
And born and bred. Like you, that's something that's like, you're a New Yorker.
I will always be a New Yorker.
And I know you didn't have an easy childhood. We don't have to, you know, go through that or dwell. But let me ask you this. Are you a good student as a kid?
I considered myself to be a good student at life.
Okay.
Not necessarily subjects.
So you were worldly in a sense. Maybe were you like old for your age kind of thing?
Yeah.
Wise for your age?
The number one word that was used to describe me when I was younger was precocious.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, now they'd probably give you pills for that, wouldn't they? Like nowadays.
Yeah.
For precocious.
I think they do.
That's called ADD now, or a hyperactivity disorder, right? I mean,
they put labels on it these days.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean you had that. I'm just, you know. And so when you're young, because I know you started working when you were very young.
Yeah, 7.
But before that, I can't even imagine that in the first place, but are you an outspoken kid? Are you outgoing? Like, what kind of kid are you?
I mean, I can just tell you how I got my start as an actor.
Yeah.
I was a dancer, and the company that I was a part of, we were doing a dress rehearsal for a big benefit for children with AIDS. And everybody was complaining. Nobody wanted to be there. So I grabbed the microphone and I told everybody off. And I said, if you don't want to be here, go home. But this is for a good cause.
Wow.
And there was a woman that they had hired from Manhattan to come out and perform, and she saw this little kid grab the mic and say her piece, and she asked if I wanted to be an actor, and I said yes. And she spoke with my mom, and my mother and I went into the city and met this woman that ended up being my manager for over 10 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking about it. I'm like 6 years old. I remember I was in a school play, and I fell off the stage because of the lights, you know, they got me disoriented and stuff. Like, I didn't know my ass from my elbow at 6 years old, but you seem, I mean, I definitely would not
were
go
you not
on stage
self-aware?
And be
like, is that it?
No, definitely not aware enough to be like, oh, people don't like this here, and this is a really good thing at 6. Maybe at like 14 is what I
think men, though, mature up later.
Okay, so you don't even think that to me, that's like, wow, I wouldn't even.
I think that's wow, because I also think it speaks a lot to who you are today, even.
Yeah.
Like, it really shows, like, oh, she's always been this, like, she's been like this. Like, she's been gutsy.
Can't keep her mouth shut.
And tenacious. But that's good.
Yeah.
We don't want people that are quiet and reserved and suppressing.
Yeah, definitely, definitely not. But I've definitely learned to be more timely with my words and to pick the right moments.
Yeah.
At times.
Does that come with maturity?
I think so. And also just, you know, I'm an observer. I'm an observer and I observe, and I'm also a Scorpio. So for me, I sometimes get a very deep satisfaction watching people dig themselves into holes and just letting them talk and not saying anything and just waiting for the right moment to lay it out. And it usually either leads to a great conversation or we never speak again.
But it also sounds kind of like the topic of your podcast, Shut Up and Listen.
Yes.
that's where you get it from. You're actually pulling your real everyday life kind of into your podcast. Isn't that the best kind of podcast?
Yeah. Editing? I feel like we try to do that.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense.
In a sense.
Absolutely. So you're 6-7 years old. You get a manager. Does she get you work when you're 6-7?
Yeah. I mean, I booked the first thing that I ever auditioned for.
Wow.
Which was an NYU short film that ended up winning the Academy Award for Best Student Film. And I was the youngest recipient of one of the highest honors from Tisch School of the Arts, which was, I didn't recognize what it was when I was that age. I was like, oh, that's nice. That's great.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It must be.
First film was an Academy Award winner.
Yeah. Did you have any grasp of the significance of it? Like, or were you more excited about like little things because you were younger?
No, I mean, for me, I always quote Morgan Freeman because I think that he says it best. I don't know if acting chose me or I chose it. Mm. It was never a question of I want to do that one day, but I am that. You know, the two most creative words ever uttered is I am, you know, followed by happy, sad, rich, poor, miserable, actor, doctor, lawyer, whatever you want to call it. You know, I can't explain it. I can't. I've tried for years and years, and it can be a lot of fun, you know, in terms of like an emotional masturbatory exercise. But really, I either connect with something or I don't. I always have. I identify with story, and I was literally just writing an essay about this. You know, people go to the movies not to see movie stars. They go to see themselves.
Right.
That's why they go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why they go. And I've always just had something that compels me and drives me that I can't even explain. It's bigger than me. Like, what I do is bigger than who I am. You know, and my role is to just continue to grow and expand and make room for it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so it really is something that you feel like, I don't know if you want it, like in a religious term, someone might say gift from God?
Serendipitous type of...
In a religious way? I mean, if you're not religious, you can obviously look at it a different way, but is that an accurate kind of analogy, if nothing else? Do you feel that?
I definitely feel like... God-given purpose, whatnot. I really do believe that every single person, there is a reason that they're here. You know, most people, though, are too afraid to venture off to discover what that is because they're scared. Mm. And I feel like the universe did for me at that age what I couldn't have done for myself. You know, like my work saved my life for a very, very, very long time.
I like to think my friend was going through this. She's going through a really hard time at her job. She works for a production company, and everyone at the production company was fired but her. And it puts her in a really weird position because, like, everybody hates her right now. But, like, on the other side, like, all her romantic problems seem to be going okay when they used to be a wreck, like, not too long ago. And I have this feeling, this belief that, like, certain things save us at a certain time and we're given, like, this balance. And... somehow our capabilities and our brain, you know, sometimes our work will save us. And when we're struggling with our work, our love life will save us. Mm-hmm. And like, it kind of just like as a Tetris type thing.
Yeah. I had this weird theory as a kid that I couldn't have a job that I liked, a girlfriend that I liked, and a car that was working at the same time. Those three things did not ever meet together.
Do they now?
No, got two.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, but to that too, I did used to believe that either that you couldn't have love and career. You really had to make a choice. You couldn't have them at the same time. And this is what I found. I spent a long time hiding in my work, and I also spent a long time hiding in my relationships. And where I am now is that I'm no longer hiding from life. I'm actually committed to life. And so because there's nowhere to hide, there's no desire. Mm-hmm. I get the gift of having my work enhance my personal love relationship, and my personal love relationship enhance my work.
Where and when did this realization come to you?
Probably within, well, it's ongoing, but really 2016 was the year of change. My 33rd year, my Jesus year. It was the year of the resurrection.
Mm-hmm. For you?
For me, okay. Personally.
Personally, spiritually, or mentally, or physically, everything?
Well, personally, spiritually,
it's
all the same. Yeah. Yeah, for just
so
me.
So everything
period.
Came together, essentially.
Yeah, everything, for you. Everything came together.
I feel like sometimes it takes a lot to. One of the keys to happiness, I re-listened to this great TED talk about happiness, and they were talking about how vulnerability ultimately is the key.
Brené Brown?
I think so. I forgot who.
Dr. Brené Brown, female from Texas.
Maybe.
Oh, she's brilliant.
Yeah.
I love her. Daring Greatly, one of the best books ever.
Yeah. So I just thought it was so interesting. And they were saying, like, if you're vulnerable with people, they'll actually appreciate you more. If you're vulnerable in your work, if you show who you really are, you'll do better. And good things will come to you. And it's, you're not hiding anymore. I thought that was really fascinating because a lot of people are very afraid to be vulnerable. And the fear just makes us more sad, and it suppresses the happiness, and it's like, it just made sense. And just, because, you know, showing being vulnerable is the opposite of hiding, really.
Well, yeah, and with that, I would add, it's so funny, I literally was just having a conversation about this last night. It's one of my favorite things to talk about because it encapsulates everything. And you and I feel, like have talked about this a little bit, that every person's biggest fear is not dying. It's being seen. Mm-hmm. And it's also every single person's single greatest desire to truly be seen. And in those moments of being completely present and being completely authentic and being completely honest, and then you are either ridiculed or your feelings are minimized, that protective layer, you know, goes on. So it's that much harder to be vulnerable. And if it was Brené Brown that you were listening to, and she talks about the courageousness of vulnerability, which is being willing to expose yourself just one more time, and not reacting, but responding.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I'm grateful that for the first time in my life, I finally been truly seen without doing anything. You know, I just was, and I was seen. And it's not enough in terms of being seen, but being held in love as you're seen. You know, because I feel like most people are, oh my God, if you truly see who I am, you are going to run in the other direction. If you truly see who I am and you know that I'm the biggest piece of shit, you're going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that
it's crippling.
We try to protect ourselves from,
mm-hmm.
but when you reach the point in your life where someone truly sees you and you're willing to sit with it and to be received and to receive the love from them, my God, it's transformational.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely transformational, you know?
So 2016, definitely. Heather, is very grounded. You mm-hmm. could tell. And 2017, because that's where we are now.
Yeah.
But so what was 2015, Heather, like? I mean, was there, I don't know, you seem like, I'm sitting here like just listening to you talk, mm-hmm. and I've done therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll just be vulnerable myself and say that mm-hmm. I'm a person that's like really, in general, like high energy and mm-hmm. frantic and mm-hmm. all kinds of issues. And what I'm seeing in you, so I got to a point this summer, which was really weird, where I lost my job, but at the same time, I got to a point in therapy that it didn't, that didn't even matter to me. Like what was going on didn't matter. And I was like the calmest I was in my entire life. And I'm looking at you and I'm listening to you and I'm like, that's kind of where I was. Like where, what, like I just feel it from you that you just have a very, like, you're very okay right now. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I like to be that way. It's fun. It's a really nice place to be, actually.
You feel like you're not that way?
Right now, I'm not. It's like somewhere I can bring myself to. Mm-hmm. I can get myself to. Like, I can do it with meditation sometimes, mm-hmm. actually. But on a daily basis, me walking through life, if I don't do meditation or if I don't talk to, like, if I didn't have, like, a therapy session once a week or whatever, then, yeah, I would just get myself back into the frantic guy. And then sometimes I would recognize that and then go, okay, well, time to meditate for, like, half an hour. And then, okay, I'm cool again for a little bit. But, like, Heather's living there, you know? And to me, honestly, I totally envy that completely. Okay. I just stopped the whole fucking
No. I love it. I mean, my question to you is this. With the job, mm-hmm. were you complaining about it all the time and saying how much you didn't like it, or did you love it?
No, I really liked it.
You really liked
it?
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, this is my experience with that. And I wrote about it a few years ago. I had written an essay called What the Fuck is Fuckable? And I had had an experience where I had been attached to a movie for over 2 years. And I had gotten one of the major stars to attach themselves. It was an incredible script. I was going to be playing this woman who was sexy and had edge and was hard. But throughout the course of the story, her emotional arc, we got to see her be vulnerable and we got to see her be soft. And I love characters that are complex and I love characters that are layered. And I was so excited for this because it was also the first time that I felt, keeping with the theme of being seen, that it was going to be an opportunity for people to see me in a different way. Not as the quirky, you know, wiener dog, Lily Moskowitz, whatever. They were going to see me as a sexual being and not just an asexual sidekick. That's funny. And I remember 2.5 weeks before we were going to start shooting, I'm in LA and I'm standing in a Starbucks with the director. And he's acting very strange. And I'm like, what's going on? And he's like, nothing, everything's fine. And I call bullshit. And I say to him, what's up? And he says to me, the producers don't want you. They said you're not fuckable. They're going with another actor. And that's after 2 years of them using my name to attract talent.
That's crazy.
It's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
And the director was very sorry and he was very upset and he was very sad and his hands were tied and there was nothing that he could do because these producers, quote unquote, are really just finance guys that don't know dick.
Yeah.
And he said that we have another role for you that's small right now, but we're going to fatten it up. Would you still do it? And I ended up saying yes. And I'm grateful that I said yes. And I'm grateful that I had the experience. Because I think the things that are really worthwhile don't come, quote unquote, easy. And if I was really being honest with myself, and I was incapable of being honest with myself back then in the way that I needed to be, I was not secure in myself as a woman. I was not secure in myself as a sexual, sensual being. It wasn't coming from a truthful, honest place. It was coming from a place of fear. And if you see me in this way and you accept me in this way, then it must mean that I'm finally there. And I don't know that it would have worked. I don't know that it would have worked. And, you know, every single thing that has happened in my life, nothing has happened to me. Everything has happened for me. Everything. You know, even when I had $54 in the bank and didn't know what the fuck was going to go on, you know, and had to get really humble and was terrified, you know, like everything. And I don't say that lightly. Like, I don't.
Okay, again, when does this realization come to you?
I mean, for fuck's sakes.
Because when you have $54 in the bank, I guarantee you're not like, this is happening for me.
No,
yay!
No, not at all.
Yeah.
You know, keeping like a very long story, somewhat condensed, sometimes I need to take a second to get very clear. I sometimes think that if we're only allocated a certain amount of words and then that's it and we can never speak again. I'm always very careful with the words that I use, not to censor but myself, but to just be as clear as possible. And so I didn't work. I was living in New York and didn't work for about 7 years. And I went through a period of, in my 20s, of real personal transformation in regards to, I felt like the universe was like, Heather, you've been playing people your whole life. Now become a person. Become a person. Mm. And I didn't know what that looked like. And I, you know, I meditated and I prayed and I read self-help books and, you know, I was of service to others and really clean living and in every single way, shape and form. And I remember in the spring of 2009, I got very suicidal. And I don't mean, you know, Lifetime movie, Valerie Bertinelli, like, oh my God, I'm going to kill myself. But very just matter of fact, I remember lying on the floor of my apartment in New York, wondering if the beams would hold my weight.
Wow, that's dark.
It's life.
Yeah.
And this depression went on for a good 6 or 7 months. And I was seeing a therapist at the time. And, you know, I had this little tiny, still small voice that was like, it's always darkest before the dawn. It's always darkest before the dawn. And a big part of that is that I believe for me, you know, we're born, we grow up, and we're not taught how to believe. We're taught what to believe, you know? And one of the things that I was taught to believe was I was raised Catholic. So I was raised under the auspice that there was this white Republican male with a beard in the sky that said yes, no, and maybe. And you had to reach 1,000, you had to meet 1,001 conditions in order to receive that unconditional love. And if you were good, good things happened to you. And my childhood, you know, to a certain degree, I was very, very, very blessed. You know, I got to work. I was afforded that privilege. But my personal life and my home life was very unstable and very dark. And I remember I would pray in my room. I would pray. I would say the Hail Mary. I would say the Our Father. And it wouldn't stop. And as a 7-year-old, as a 6-year-old, as a 5-year-old, as an 8-year-old, subconsciously or not, the connection that I made was, well, I must not be good because the prayers aren't being answered. And I was told in no uncertain terms that God answers your prayers if you are a good girl. And then I found out I was a lesbian, for fuck's sakes. You know, so So my whole entire life, you know, I've had this divine searching. I've had this just wanting to have that connection with that thing. And in my 20s, the old God of my childhood came back with a vengeance, because I saw that my life wasn't working, and I didn't understand why. You know, when I would pray and I would say, if I'm not meant to be an actor, you need to let me know, because then I'll do something else. And then I would get the audition, and the audition would be for a series regular on like an incredible show. And then I would know the director and I'd know the writer. And then I'd go to the audition and I'd see somebody else that I knew that was going in for a different part. And I'd be like, yes, thank you. Like, thank you for the sign. And then I wouldn't get it. I was like, what kind of sick and twisted sadomasochistic God is this?
Right.
Yeah.
And I felt so incredibly powerless. I'd never felt more powerless in my life. And that again goes back to that childhood teaching that we have no power. God has all power. God says yes, no, and maybe. And you just kind of have to take it. There's this idea that there's nobility in suffering. There's this idea that, especially for girls, pleasure is bad. That if you feel good, and I mean you feel good, that you're doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. And that if you are suffering and you are earning your keep, that is considered virtuous. And I obviously didn't end up killing myself. But in September of 2009, I was given a book by my ex-fiance's father, who's since passed away and was probably one of the most magical beings. Like, her family was very, very metaphysical. And it was a book called The Words and Wisdom of Florence Scovel Shinn. And within that same week, I also got the book Conversations with God by Neil Donald Walsh. And those two books changed my life, because they answered every single internal question I had in terms of, like, I got to find that, oh, I'm not powerless. Oh, I can ask for what I want. Like, that's okay. That's not bad. That's not wrong. I get to actually create opportunities in my life. I have more power than I think I do. And I spent between 2009 through 2016 working with that and stumbling and falling and failing and getting up and trying again. And why doesn't this work? And why doesn't that work? And oh my God, here's an unexpected gift and blah, 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 blah. I just wanted to find the one thing, the key and the lock that would unlock the door that would lead me to freedom. And I know that this is a long ramble and I'm sorry, but the point is that I had to get to such a bottom, which I did in 2015, that allowed me to say yes to things that I had been so scared of saying yes to before. And what that was for me was I got to experience the plant spirit medicine ayahuasca. And it truly, it not only changed my life, it saved my life, legitimately. Hmm.
And okay, was this just a one-time, one-shot deal or multiple times? Have you tried DMT?
So 2014, make the decision to move to Los Angeles. And again, at the time, I'm with a therapist who I love very much, who is incredibly, incredibly smart, and I owe him a lot, though I'm sure I was able to give him a house.
I always say I funded my therapist's second beach house.
There you go. And I'd been going to therapy specifically to deal with depression. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing that's so funny about depression. I didn't know that I suffered from depression until I would have moments of being truly suicidal. Because otherwise, I just thought I was tired. Hmm.
I feel like that's classic depression, though. You don't realize you're depressed.
Yeah, you don't. You're just like, oh, this is just life. I'm just fucking tired all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and I had also been going because I had had, like, fine, I'll just be honest. Because I'd had sexual trauma in my past that, you know, was a hindrance, you know, and I really truly felt like I was a prisoner in my own body. Mm-hmm. And I love Ilanya Van Sant's, description of that. And she calls it neck down dead, you know.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, just neck down dead. And so we had been doing a lot of intense fucking work, and I'm always down to do fucking work because I wanted to have the full experience of living. And he had said, you know, have you ever thought of doing ayahuasca? And I was like, what was that? And of course, as everything happens exactly the way it was meant to, I was led to one person who led me to another person. And that person happened to be the sister of somebody that I had gone to high school with. And I did 2 years worth of research, and I had found out that, you know, people that suffer from PTSD, which I had suffered from, people that suffer from depression, it was used for, vets that were coming home from war. And it is not for everybody. Like, it's not like, oh my God, man, I'm gonna like go and like get high and like have a good time. You know, like you're shitting and you're vomiting. And I'd never taken a hallucinogen or an entheogen in my life ever.
Yeah.
But what led me to saying yes was cut to October of 2015, where 2015, moved to LA, September of 2014, January of 2015, my birth dad dies. April of 2015, my adoptive dad dies. Oh. And, you know, just starting to feel, again, really dark and really depressed, and I'm in therapy and I'm praying and I'm meditating and I'm not drinking and I'm doing all this stuff and I'm doing all the things I should be doing.
And yet the dominoes are still falling.
And yet it's not even that like the dominoes are falling. It literally was like, I'm back to, I want to kill myself. Oh, and 2 days before I'd moved, found out that the love of my life, my dog, Henry Miller, was diagnosed with a heart tumor and given 1 to 6 months to live. Oh. And like just celebrated his 1 year anniversary of his passing. Oh. So cut to then October of 2015, where I am again suicidal and just fuck. I don't know what to do. Like, I'm done. And an opportunity arose for me to participate in a week-long ceremony. And I was reading Shonda Rhimes' book, The Year of Yes. And I got the opportunity, and my first instinct was no, because I'm terrified.
Yeah.
And then I reread the page that I was reading in the book, and I was like, you fucking idiot. Say yes. And I listened to that voice and I said yes, and then cut to February of 2016. And I went on this journey by myself with like 11 other people. And it was a week long and it was completely life changing. And that feeling that I had had my whole life, that desire essentially to go home, and that's what I feel like suicide is. You know, it's not, you know, I just want to end it. It's, I want to go home. I just want to go home. I want to go back to peace.
It's a safety blanket or something.
No, it's not safety.
Not safety, security. I don't know. It's like,
it's home. It's home. It's unconditional love. It's home. It's home. And, I got to have that experience. And here's the thing, as somebody that had never taken a hallucinogen or an entheogen and didn't know what the fuck to expect. There's a reason it's been used for thousands upon thousands of years. Two completely separate plants that come together that formulate DMT. There's thousands upon thousands upon thousands of plants. And yet, the indigenous people knew to bring those two together. And so I didn't just have an experience, I had a knowing. I had an awakening. It was like every single thing really, truly, deeply within me that I... This is the best example I can give. It's like if Dorothy Gale from Kansas is sitting on her porch and she's 95 years old. And she's starting to wonder if Oz was just a figment of her imagination, if she had ever really had the experience. And then somebody comes directly from Oz and is like, oh my God, no, like you're right. Like it exists. Hmm. And you were there. And so there's that, oh, I'm so grateful to know that, like, I wasn't fucking crazy. Like, I'm so grateful to know that what I'd always suspected and hoped wasn't just a figment of my imagination, but the realest thing I've ever encountered.
Would you call this a vision quest?
I would call it a soul retrieval.
Okay. And you've been changed ever since.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing to preface. It's not a magic bullet. It's not a magic bullet. It's not, oh my God, I saw fairies. I didn't. And now everything's fine. You know, I remember the day that I got back, my ex, there's a reason she's my ex, you know, asked how my experience was. And I was like, oh my God, it was incredible. And I'll share something with you guys. But she was like, oh, that's not what like I expected, you know, and just really kind of shitting on the experience. But the last day I was there and I'd had like a huge, huge, beautiful, brilliant experience the second night. But the last day it was a daytime ceremony up in the mountains. And this wasn't done in the United States, but was like up in the mountains. And I started to hear this voice and I started to look around at these people that I had formed these close bonds with. And I heard this voice saying, nobody here loves you. No one here cares about you. You're going home alone. No one loves you. And it wouldn't stop. And I started crying in a way that was almost primal and animalistic. And I couldn't stop. And the voice just kept coming and coming and coming. And I remember when the ceremony was over, like, I felt so fucking shitty. And I'm like, I'm leaving even shittier. I'm leaving feeling even shittier than when I came here. You know, like, I was coming here as a last stop. Like, if this didn't work, I didn't know what I was going to do. And the next morning, I woke up and I took a shower and I got out of the shower and I had a memory as clear as day. Last day of filming the first film that I'd done when I was 7, and I'm crying because, you know, you work with people for a month and a half, you get really close. Mm-hmm. And I remember my mother saying to me, why are you crying? Stop crying. Nobody here loves you. Nobody here cares about you. I'm the only one that loves you. I'm the only one that cares about you. No one else loves you. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. And in that moment, you know, I had the recognition and the remembrance that, oh, not that I'm allowed to love, but I'm allowed to connect with others. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm allowed to connect with others. I'm allowed to love others. I'm allowed to have that. Like, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I didn't know that I had been carrying that with me, that that seed had planted and you know, weeded itself into the very depth of my being, and had become such a part of me, you know? And so I've gone now from belief to knowing, you know, like when you know, there's no questioning. It just is. Like, I know I'm sitting here. That makes sense.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I do a lot of research and take a lot of notes and all that stuff. And you are a guest that I really don't need the research so much, but just because you're very interesting, just not for any other reason. But, you know, one of the things that I did read about you is you kind of mentioned like a big misnomer of from the public, essentially from working actors, right? They automatically assume that you're rich, right? Your eyes just rolled, I think, way back in the far back of your head. So that's something that you've dealt with for a long time.
I'm rich in life experience.
But as far as, but monetarily, people assume that just because, and you've worked on some of the biggest shows, mm-hmm. TV shows, movies, and all that stuff, and people just automatically assume because of this, you are rich.
Yeah.
And you run into that a lot.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know where I was going with that. Other than just to get to the part where, you know, and you kind of already mentioned it, where, you know, you have gone through periods of time where you weren't working, right? So what do you do as an actor when you're, like, what keeps you going? What is just the belief that there will be something one day?
You know what? And here's the thing, right? Where every single thing happens exactly the way that it's meant to. Probably one of the most expensive lessons I've ever learned is don't take care of your significant other financially. Hmm. Do not do it. And that very expensive lesson. And here's the thing is that, you know, pardon me. There's this conception in Hollywood, and one that I definitely was under the illusion of, that you have to maintain this facade. You have to maintain this mystery that everything is good all of the time. And so when I would pray and I would be like, oh my God, what do I do? Because I need to make money. Like, oh my, what am I going to do? And again, like 7 years is a long time. And I would have like little things. I do like an episode of Law and Order, or I would do this. And like at the time, like my residuals were my lifesaver, you know, and a lot of what people don't know about residuals is that they don't stay the same rate forever and ever and ever. So I get residuals now for literally a penny.
Right.
Yeah.
It costs more to send it out.
I know. I got like a 3 cent residual the other day for something I did like when I was like 16.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And I'm grateful that I've been afforded the opportunity that I have so much work that, you know, has allowed me to eat. However, you know, this past year, I really, again, you know, living in Los Angeles, I'd sold my apartment in New York and wasn't, like, independent films pay nothing. They pay nothing. They pay $125 a day. And they usually go for like 14 days. You know, and I've been doing this for almost 30 years where I was used to working for 2 or 3 months at a time, you know, and even with those big movies that I did, yes, I will say that I got paid more than quite a large segment of the population earns in a year. However, with that, what people don't recognize is A, and I'm just going to use a number, mm-hmm. you know, because I'm not like a high six figure actor. I'm not even like a low six figure actor, but this is like a easy number. So you do a big studio film that you're one of the leads of, and let's say you make $100,000, mm-hmm. right? $20,000 automatically comes off the top because of your agent and your manager. And then if you have a lawyer, that's another 5%. So where are we right now? 75,000? Great. Okay, so we're at $75,000, and then the government takes about 40%. So we're at...
I'm so
who's
bad
doing the math in their head? But we're well, I mean, so 50% of 75,000 would be what, 32.5? No, my way off. That's 60.
Yeah, no, 38.
I have a calculator.
37.5.
Yes. 37.
So let's say, okay, 37. And then that's not including SAG.
Right.
Right.
Like pension and health. Yeah. Ba, 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 ba. So you have federal tax, you have state tax, you have city tax. Then you get taxed if you're doing the film in a city that you don't live, in a state that you don't live. So you're paying a fuck ton of money.
Yeah.
And then, you know, big, huge studio roles don't just continually fall out of the sky. So $32,000 has to stretch for a really, really, really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in a tiny studio in New York that was under 200 square feet, you know? And I made my money stretch as much as possible, you know? But again, back to the point, the bigger point, which is that, you know, I woke up from the fucking illusion that I had to maintain this facade. And in 2016, you know, I accepted a teaching position to supplement my income. And I also started, you know, reading scripts and giving notes on the side, which is teaching me a lot and also incredibly infuriating. And, you know, I did it because it was like, I've got to put food on the table. And then this past December, really, like, I mean, again, like 2016 was like such a fuck all of a year of change. You know, I got to this point where I realized that I'd never truly fully committed to living my life. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm, totally.
I was surviving, but I wasn't thriving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you feel unworthy, how are you going to build any wealth?
Mm-hmm. Right.
How are you going to, you know, like if
your self-worth is so low,
yes.
How can you get worth?
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just had like a wake up call where essentially like I handed in my ultimate, you know, card. I handed in my death card. You know, when I make a commitment, I make a commitment. When I say I'm going to do something, I do something.
Mm-hmm.
And when I give my word, I give my word. And I said, yes. Okay. I will commit to life. Like somebody said, like live life with me, like live life. And I said, yes. And that to me is like saying yes to a marriage proposal. Mm-hmm. It's like the marriage proposal of the soul. And so I handed in my death card, the ultimate death card, because I always thought, and this is very dark, but it's true, and I'm just fucking honest, that if it ever got really bad, I could just kill myself. It ever got really, really bad again. And then also in 2016, a month after I got back from my trip, Henry died. And then that July, my cat of 13 years got eaten by coyotes.
Oh my gosh.
I know. It's
horrible.
It was 2 years of transformation, but it's like, that's, you got to walk through the fire, right? It's like the phoenix rising from the ashes.
True.
So once I said yes to really living life, I had to stop and I had to be like, well, what actually is it to live life? Where am I not?
Right.
Whose life am I living? What the fuck have I been doing?
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, I had a few other experiences in like the last few months of 2016 that allowed me to work through some of that trauma. But with that too, really truly gave me back to self. And it was the first time in my life that I started to feel pleasure, and with feeling true, real, like rooted, grounded pleasure, I started to feel power. And I got a really huge case of the divine fuckets, where I said, if I never work again as an actor, so be it. That's fine. I'm willing to let that go. But what I'm not willing to do anymore is put myself on sale and give other people that power. You know, it's an illusion anyway, right?
Yeah.
And I started the Patreon page, which was a huge leap of faith, because I was like, what is it that I desire to do? Where's my passion? Where's my heart? And for me, it's as a storyteller. And my desire is to be able to have one of the biggest production companies in this industry, and also is the most inclusive, where we get to focus on telling stories, period. That it's not the straight, that it's not the like straight white male narrative, the schlubby guy who wins the girl who's out of his league and like blah, blah, blah.
Like every TV show these days?
Like everything, you know, whatever the fuck it is, but real true stories. Because again, what we talked about in the beginning, people don't go to the movies, you know, to see movie stars, they go to see themselves. And there's a large segment of the population that they're not seeing themselves on screen. You know, and not just physical representations, but also like emotional and spiritual representations, because I can't identify with like a boy fighting aliens on a foreign planet, but I identify with the fear. I identify with the loss. I identify with the anger. I identify with the rage. But if you have storytellers that are predominantly white and male that are not interested in the unique voice of women, women of color, you know, people who are, you know, Muslim or Jewish or any of the proverbial others, you know, it's not going to be honest and it's not going to be authentic. And for me, I just want to be able to authentically tell stories and be able to keep an air hanger door open for as many people to have as many opportunities as possible.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So that sounds like a good passion that you have right now. Like it's something that's driving you essentially.
I mean, but that's the thing, is that's what's always driven me.
Yeah.
But because my pleasure was so muted, the passion was so muted, you know, and because the passion was so muted and the pleasure was so muted, the power was almost non-existent,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I would sound like a whiny brat. I don't understand why,
yeah.
You know, and I was too terrified to ask myself the question, why not? Why not me? And in those moments, in those rare moments where I would be angry and fuck off, it never lasted. Mm-hmm. And it was always, well, this is how things are. You just have to play by the rules. You have to follow the script. You have to do this. You have to sacrifice yourself in order to get to the place that you want to be. And the good girl that I had within me, I was like, fine, I'm like willing to do this. So I would like say yes to auditions that I didn't want to go in on for shows that never ended up getting picked up because they were pieces of shit. You know, I said yes to movies I didn't want to say yes to. And with this too, like this is the flip side, right? Where I've always prided myself on being very selective with the projects that I pick, you know, because why do people, you know, people that are going to take time out of their day to see a movie and pay the money and blah, 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 blah. And with that too, though, like I had to recognize that my ego, I love being told that like I'm an incredible actor. I love being told that people really respect me and the choices I've made. And when you're put into a position where it's you have to make a choice to say yes to something that you know to a certain degree is beneath you, which is very elitist. And I will call myself out on that. but with that too, you know, the bill's got to be paid.
Right.
And I was always so worried, like, oh my God, I'm going to be in this piece of shit movie. And like, what are people going to think of me? And they're not going to want to work with me anymore. And I had to get to the point where I was like, if they say anything, like, are you going to pay my bills?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I just listened to Timothy Olyphant.
Blah, blah.
Yeah. He did an NPR podcast, I think, with Terry Gross or something. And she asked him, like, what draws you to certain movies or TV shows? Because he just did Santa Clarita Diet. And he's like, I just need a paycheck.
Yes.
And I loved that. I was like,
yes.
He's like, yeah, I like acting. I'm really thrilled I get to do what I like to do.
Yeah.
But I just want to be here in 5 years with like and feed my kids.
Yeah. And what I say is that if the script's not tight, the money better be right.
Right. That's because, a good motto. Yeah. I want that on a bumper sticker.
If the script's not tight, the money better be right.
Yeah. You can make tote bags of that.
I was going to say, make a t-shirt.
Yeah. Well, that's I will.
Yeah, make them on sale now.
There'll be a link in the bio here with the
merch is coming.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this question. I know we're kind of past it and we're kind of getting towards the end, but I feel like I have to ask you this question.
Anything.
I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this question. September 11th, 2001. You're supposed to be in the 15th floor of World Trade Center 1.
Yeah.
And being, you know, I told you earlier, I'm from New Jersey. So I have friends that, like, one of my friends got too drunk the night before watching the Giants game, Jets game, whatever it was. And he was late to work. And that's the only reason he wasn't in the tower in like the 50th floor.
Yeah.
So like everybody has stories. So I'm just curious as to what your story was and how that changed. That had to have affected your life too, right?
I mean, I'll tell you what. I'm just barely. I have such a backlog of things that I need to
deal with.
That I need to look at and deal with. And I think the September 11th thing is definitely one of them. You know, I had just gotten back from North Carolina from doing this movie that never saw the light of day, thank Christ. But again, everything happened exactly the way it was meant to. And I was rooming with somebody because it was that low budget. And she was really into the Landmark Forum. And she had suggested that I sign up and do it. And I was like, okay. And so I had like written a check and I'd sent some money, but I had to bring in the final deposit that day.
Yeah.
And I had just, and I was staying at my mom's house at the time. Cause I think I was like 18 at the time. Yeah. Like 18. And I remember that I was supposed to wake up at 6 o'clock and take the 7 o'clock train and get into Penn Station and then go down to the Trade Center and be there by 9. And I think I smoked some weed the night before. And I woke up at 8:52 in the morning and was like, oh, fuck, I overslept. God, I gotta, like, go. And fuck, oh my God, you piece of shit. I'm like, meh. And then come to find that I wasn't going anywhere because you know, two planes that hit the Trade Center.
Yeah, that's, I mean, unbelievably horrible. And you know, one of the things that, I mean, for me, I took like classes in the city and stuff. I was a day trader. And in 99 and 2000, right before I moved out here in April of 2015, so kind of shortly before it all happened.
2015?
I mean, of 2001, sorry. But the thing that really struck me, like as a person from that area, I would walk out of the Trade Center and I would just turn around and look up and just marvel at how humongous this building was. And when it actually happened, I really thought, like, you know, I think it's a miracle that only 3,000 people died in the towers, because if you knew, I mean, there's a mall on the bottom level, on the first level, and the bottom level was the PATH trains. So that's thousands and thousands of people getting off trains. And like, it's just a, to me still, like to this day, I can't believe.
But I'll tell you something. And I feel like this is really, really important. And I love that John Stewart actually, is such an advocate, you know. 3,000 people died that day, but so many more, have died and are dying because of like first responders, firefighters, policemen, other individuals that are dying of cancer. That it's atrocious. And what's even more atrocious is that our government actually has turned their back and they don't want to help these individuals that have, that risked not only their physical health and but their mental health. You know, it was a traumatizing event, obviously. And yeah, it's crazy how life works, you know. So every September 11th, I definitely do take a moment and I'm like, well, I must be here for a reason, but it's so far removed from me that it almost feels like that didn't happen to me. It happened to somebody else. Like, that can't be my experience. How could that, you know what I mean? Like, it's because, you know, Jesus didn't come down from heaven and say, I saved you that day because you have more work to do. You know, I floundered around for another Jesus Christ, almost like 14 years. And it really has been like this last year that I feel like, you know, my life is getting to take off. But I always said that from the time I was a kid. I was like, my life isn't going to take off until I'm in like my mid to late 30s.
How the hell do you know that?
Because all of the women that I really loved, like all of the roles that I loved, like the alcoholic mothers and the like, you know, Frances McDormand types. I was like, that's it. Like Frances McDormand, Patty Clarkson, Julianne Moore.
You saw yourself in them.
I saw myself in them.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Something interesting that someone told me once when I was quite young, but I think about it a lot, is that when my mom died, because a lot of people were coming up to me and telling me things, and like as a 13-year-old, you know, you're like, oh, people are telling me all these things all the time. And someone came up to me and they're like, people are going to tell you a lot of shit. They're going to try to give you a lot of advice. And the good advice, you're going to blow off until it's too late. You're going to be like, fuck, I didn't do it. And everything else is going to be bullshit. And you have to focus on taking the advice from someone who is where you want to be at that moment. Like, if you're homeless, you want advice from the homeless guy next to you that was warm last night. You don't want advice from him on how to get out of being homeless, but you need advice from him right now on how to survive that day. And he knows. So it's like, you got to categorize that and take advice from the people who are where you need to be at that moment. And then the rest is just people are being stupid and just like bombarding you.
Yeah. And with that too, it's so interesting because most people don't want to be where they are in that moment. And it takes an extraordinary event to allow them to be so present, you know, whether it, and it's usually a death. You know, of some kind.
Something drastic.
Something incredibly drastic that everything stops and they're brought right back to now. But other than that, most people are like, I want to be where they are. You know, like, which is...
That's like looking at someone who's really fit and being like, I need to get that fit. It's like, you got to do the work. You got to train, and it's going to hurt, and you're not going to like it, and it's going to take time, and you can't change overnight. No one likes change. They're very comfortable in where they are, and that's why I take such drastic things sometimes to give us that nudge.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah. There's this coffee mug that I have that's a quote from Neil Donald Walsh, which is life begins at the edge of your comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
I love that quote.
I'm comfortably uncomfortable all the time, like growing or dying.
I want a mug
That's it. I'll get you that mug.
You have all kinds of merch that you have to start putting together.
Yeah, you gotta sell that merch.
That's
Shut Up and Listen.
That's Walsh's mug, but I will have merch for Shut Up and Listen.
Yeah,
I will.
I feel like you've had a lot of good pieces of nuggets that you could put into a mug.
Did we learn anything like really good about Eden on episode 3 of Shut Up and Listen?
Two.
Damn it.
It's episode 2.
I really did a terrible job doing research. But what did we learn about Eden? Anything good? Anything that you're like, wow.
Why are you exposing me?
I don't know. I figured that way people will listen to that show if they want to hear a little bit more
about... They should listen to the other two.
Well, of course, but...
They should just subscribe and leave a review.
You should just shut up and listen.
Every fucking week. No, I mean, here's the thing that's so great is one of the beautiful things about Twitter is that it allows... relationships to be formed, you know, that otherwise wouldn't have been able to happen.
Yeah.
And because I'm a hermit, I don't go anywhere. I don't go to Hollywood parties. I really don't. There has to be a good reason for me to get dressed up and go out. And what I learned with you, because I didn't know what to really expect, aside from the fact that you are a very centered individual, you also... are incredibly, incredibly earnest. And I will add this.
Okay.
I don't think you give yourself enough credit because it's your life and it's yours. So there's no, you know what? I've actually worked through some shit and like, I am pretty fucking amazing. And like you're the kind of individual that I desire to work with, you know, that like is honest and forthright and has a very, very clear voice. And you reminded me to take that opportunity for myself to be like, yeah, I've gone through some shit and like, it's all good because isn't that always the way that like we see in others what we most need to see in ourselves,
mm-hmm.
you know? So you were a beautiful mirror for me,
that's
you
good.
Know, and it's the start of what I think is going to be a beautiful friendship.
I love it.
And you mentioned Twitter, Heather Mataraz, no O, your whole name except for the O.
Yeah. Heather Mataraz.
Was that on purpose? Did somebody steal your name? Yeah,
couldn't fit the O.
I didn't think about that.
And then you can also follow the Shut Up and Listen podcast at SUALWHM. Shut Up and Listen with Heather Mataraz.
Oh, there you go.
There's a separate Twitter.
Yeah. Okay. Separate Twitter like for the show.
Right.
Yeah.
Perfect. Do you have a favorite charity?
Me.
You. Mm-hmm. Heather, do you have a favorite charity?
Yes, myself.
Okay.
That's what I meant.
Sorry.
No, my favorite, you know what? I'll tell you what. Barkin' Bitches.
Barkin' Bitches. What's Barkin' Bitches?
Barkin' Bitches.
It's this awesome place.
It's where I got, I adopted my dog, Nenea.
Okay.
Whose name means girl full of grace. That was her name when I rescued her from Barkin' Bitches.
Hmm.
And she also has my same birthday. It was serendipitous.
Oh,
wow.
Perfect.
So she's a Scorpio.
Yeah, she's a little Scorpio. But Barkin' Bitches is one, also the Hetrick Martin Institute, which deals with gay and lesbian students in New York, part of the Harvey Milk High School.
Wait, stop right there. Just because, yeah. So you know what I'm going to do? What? I'm going to split, because usually we just give it to one, but we're going to give $100 to both of your charities.
Oh my God.
Tell me the second one again, because I wasn't fast enough. I was writing Barkin' Bitches.
It's HMI.
Mm-hmm.
which is the Hetrick Martin Institute, which is part of the Harvey Milk High School.
Okay.
Which is the school that, so if kids have gotten kicked out of their house and they're homeless and they're gay, you know, the Harvey Milk, that's where they will go to school and they will set up job interviews. And, you know, some of those kids like need like a toothbrush. It's absolutely crazy.
Great. So we're going to give money to them. And of course, in our bio, in the show description, there's always a link to the charity. So feel free to donate yourself.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to the audience, obviously. So, Heather, thank you so much for being on the show. We really appreciate it. You're awesome.
Thanks for having me.
Really interesting. Edin, thank you.
Thank you, Guy.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to Failing Up.
Thanks, everyone.